11:07 on KTSA. Hi there, Jack, for Wednesday morning. We welcome now to the KTSA Window World Newsmaker line, Lisa Daftari, who's the founder and editor-in-chief of ForeignDeskNews.com. ForeignDeskNews.com, a daily stop for me, and it should be for you, to catch up on all the things that get little or no space in our domestic news coverage. And we're going to talk with Lisa about a few of them right now. Lisa, good morning to you.
Good morning.
We get a lot of reporting about the caravan, and in Texas we get a fair amount of reporting about the troop movements, obviously. But as I was reading some of the articles that you linked to this morning, I was thinking about this. What exactly do you think or do you hear is the intel? What do they know? What does our military, what does our Border Patrol know about who's in that caravan?
Right, so I think that's the fixation here. There's a couple of different questions, and as you pointed to find out, most importantly, who's in that caravan and what is their primary agenda. Watching the evolution of the migrant movement for the past 5 or 6 years, we know that most migrants are men. They're not families, as they are often reported to be so. Most of them are coming from different parts of the world, meaning when we talk about a caravan coming from El Salvador or Guatemala or any other nation, whether it's Venezuela or, in fact, Syria, we see that there are other individuals who are taking advantage of the global kindness that surrounds this, again, quote-unquote, humanitarian crisis. But the point is, from a national security perspective, the question is not to look at this as from the point of view of as a humanitarian crisis, but more so as a national security one. Who's in this caravan? What do they want? When you have Palestinians and Bangladeshis, Indonesians, Somalians mixed into the crowd, then you have to ask some questions. When you have the offer on the table by Mexico to absorb many of these migrants, to give them jobs, to give them home, to give them refuge, and they are refusing that offer, then again the question becomes, if they are truly seeking asylum, why are they not jumping on the opportunity to find asylum where they are being offered asylum? I think these are the main questions. A lot of the reports from the ground specifically are saying that there are a lot of men, mostly men. Secondly, that it, again, it's not a homogenous group from Central South America. This is a mixed group of opportunists that we fear will pose a national security threat.
We're talking with Lisa Daftari from ForeignDeskNews.com on KTSA right now. There was a story on the CBS Evening News about the Iranian sanctions, and the gist of the story was that the Iranian people are really feeling the effects, that it is dramatically inflating the price of everything they buy, and it's making, for people that already have a life of hardship, it's making their life harder. Do you think that's accurate, and is that going to translate to what obviously U.S. policymakers want it to translate to, which is from the bottom up pressure on the Iranian government?
Right. I think that's, you know, that's what we've been watching for the last 3 decades or more in Iran. And when you look at the time period in which the sanctions did little to no harm onto the Main Street economy, that was under Rafsanjani. Rafsanjani was a more moderate, and I hate to use that term when it comes to the Iranian regime, because ever since the toppling of the Shah in 1979, they've all been part of the same government, part of the same system, part of this Islamic republic. So I hate to use that word, but relatively speaking, he was moderate and he used economic reform, meaning he used subsidies to take off that economic harshness of the sanctions, so that the people would stay off the streets, that the people would be satiated, and that was definitely a smart move. You didn't hear about these protests during his time. But now what's curious about the situation is that the Achilles heel of the Iranian government has been, always will be, the people coming out onto the streets. They know that that's what toppled the Shah, and the people are at that breaking point where that hunger and that unemployment and the inflation will drive them out onto the streets, as we've seen. the ability to organize, to use social media, to come out and tell their story to the world also has evolved tremendously. They're extremely savvy and sophisticated in that manner. So, you know, what's curious about the situation is how will this play out and how will the regime play this out? Meaning, when you have the world, you know, focused and zoomed in on how you behave with regards to human rights, with regards to your nuclear program, with regards to your own people, if those people should come out onto the streets because they've reached a breaking point, how will you then react? Will you have extreme, you know, violence, you know, cracking down on the protesters, or will they let it go? And if they let it go, what will that mean? Will they have international support in taking this protest to the next level?
You know, when we talk about this stuff, I'm reminded of, and I know we've mentioned this book before, The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright, where he basically explains how for decades and decades, governments in that part of the world have explained the people's misery to them as being externally caused, and they have inoculated themselves against revolt and revolution by saying, yeah, you're right, things are terrible, we're living in the 7th century, it's the West, it's the corrupt, decadent
Absolutely.
West. So isn't that what the Iranian regime can do now? Can't they say, it's Trump?
That's what they used to do. That's exactly, and you nailed it, really. This is exactly what they used to do. They used to use the sanctions, pass that burden of or the penalty of the economic sanctions onto the main street economy and stand back and say, it's not us, it's the big Satan. It's the big Satan. And they used to get people to rally around the flag because of that propaganda.
Why will that not work now?
Because the people are extremely cognizant. When you look at the slogans, I mean, the best way to study, you know, the evolution of the Iranian protester is to look at these slogans. They are so well written, and they rhyme, and they're so really just high context. And they are saying on the streets, they're saying, I don't care about Gaza, I don't care about Lebanon, I only care about Iran. Or, you know, they're calling out the fact of the hypocrisy of the regime to pour money into Hezbollah's pockets and into Syria and into Yemen, but then starve the people in Iran. People are extremely aware and awake right now. And because of that awareness, they no longer buy the fact. There's actually a very pro-Trump sentiment across, you know, different parts of society in Iran because of the support that they didn't see in the last administration. They see the lack of support, or I would say the very lukewarm support of President Obama in 2009 and the Green Revolution as the biggest missed opportunity, and they're absolutely right to think that way. And it wasn't a missed opportunity. It was by design in order to strike a deal with the mullahs a couple years later. And the people see that. They're aware of that, whether it's social media or the fact that they, again, have reached a breaking point where this cognizance is what they see day in and day out. They're basically in a post-propaganda chapter of their history. They're not going to buy into the garbage that's being fed to them by the regime, and they are very well aware that there is money and that the regime is putting it into its nefarious activities in the region.
Lisa Daftari, ForeignDeskNews.com. It's an everyday read. Lisa, thank you as always. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
11:16 on News Talk, 550 KTSA, FM 107.1, and at KTSA.com.